So just this past week, Wendy came to me with an article in a magazine, an edition of Canadian Living. And it's all about why they're saying families are going back to religion. So obviously I was really interested in this and read the article through, and I just want to share some of the things that I read in this. So one of them is a woman by the name of Margaret, and she's gone back actually to St. Clement's Anglican Church just up the street here, and she's got two small daughters. And she said, you know, I have lots of doubts, and I knew that when my children got into complicated questions, I wouldn't have the answers for them. The church would. And she says, you know, some of the time-worn phrases of the liturgy and the songs may have lost their meaning, but at the same time, she loves their familiarity. Another young mom said, birth is a profound experience that makes you realize that you are not in control of your universe. Another person, a 16-year-old by the name of Heather, she goes to a youth group at St. John's Anglican Church, and she said, at this age, all the kids want to do is get drunk every weekend. A lot of kids do it because they don't have enough reasons not to, but my faith kind of gives me an extra reason not to drink. Another couple came back after many years and were really appreciative of a church that said God allows U-turns. And they experienced a huge difference by having a community around them that would support them. Another couple going to a United Church says, you know, we're talking about the importance of Christmas and how they were connecting church now to Christmas in the first time. We read the children's Bible throughout December. My husband was asked to read the Christmas story at the Christmas service. Having church back in Christmas was really lovely. And then they talked about the challenges that the church is facing with this emerging, with this generation. They said, you know, this is a generation that is visually literate and stimulus greedy. Visually literate and stimulus greedy. We are dealing with a generation where if you can't see it and you can't hear it, you just change channels. Well, I thought, wow, that certainly speaks to our culture today. Now, what I didn't mention was the date of the magazine. It's actually August of 1992. That's right, the Canadian Living magazine of August 1992. So generation they were talking about, that was me. So that was me back then, and my daughter Sarah was 4 and Lizzie was 1. And I had just finished my first month at Westminster United Church in Whitby when this magazine came out. But what really interests me is if you can compare what was said in this magazine to what was said in the video on Spirit Space that we shared last week, you'll see that every generation asks the same questions. Every generation has the same issues. We just have to tell it and reflect it differently to speak to each emerging generation. So I'm very interested to find out what happened to these people back in 1992. Are they still connected to church? And so I'm going to be doing some research, and I'll get back to you on that as soon as I can find out. So that was that's sort of the start here. So today we're moving on our series of answering the questions from the survey, and this is the question about the divinity of Jesus. Was Jesus divine? So I wish to frame this question through two lenses. And the first lens is through one of my favorite authors, the British author Neil Gaiman, who has written a wonderful book called American Gods. And its interesting premise is that America is filled with gods from the ancient world, but they have lost their power because nobody believes in them anymore, which may in fact be a bit of a parable for us. And so now the ancient gods are sort of living ordinary lives. Some have small businesses, others drive cabs. They have their conflicts, but it's a fascinating sort of theology that's behind this. Now, Gaiman gave a speech to a group of librarians a few years ago that I just heard this speech the other day. And it's a fabulous speech on the importance of libraries and of reading, specifically reading to children. He points out something that I never imagined regarding the prison industry in the United States. Now, the levels of incarceration in the United States are just massive, they're just huge. And it's a huge industry, private prisons in the US. And so, like every organization, every business, they have to sort of plan for the future. and decide how many prison cells they're going to need. So they have an algorithm, and the algorithm projects the need for prisons based on this. The number of 10 and 11-year-olds in any given year who can't read. It's the number of 10 and 11-year-olds in any given year who can't read, and also factors in those who are never read to or don't read or won't read. But just think about that. The rate of literacy determines the future prison population. And as I listened to this lecture, he talked again about the power of story. And last week, I gave that quote that the people who tell stories rule the world. And I just saw this morning at breakfast, when I was reading the book review part of the New York Times that came with my star, a review of Fantasyland. It's a book on how the United States got to where they are and how Donald Trump is actually the logical conclusion to 200 years of American history. And he says, the author says, that what the United States needs now is a story to end all stories. A story to end all stories. And this is what Neil Gaiman says. He says, stories take you into a different world outside of your own experience. So stories and fiction give you a different perspective, exposes you to a different viewpoint, and in so doing, creates empathy. Empathy. And he also says the truth of the story isn't that it actually happened, but in what it means, but in what it means. So I want us to put sort of the power of story up there as a way of seeing truth, as a way of creating empathy. And now I want to move on to one of my favorite writers, nonfiction writers, Brené Brown. And I shared her video last year on the difference between sympathy and empathy. And she has a new book called Braving the Wilderness, and I just want to read just a section of that now. So what she writes, she says, "The world feels high lonesome and heartbroken to me right now. We have sorted ourselves into factions based on our politics and ideology. We've turned away from one another and toward blame and rage. We're lonely and untethered and scared, so darn scared. But rather than coming together and sharing our experiences through song and story, we are screaming at one another from further and further away. When I look through the 200,000 plus pieces of data my team and I have collected over the past 15 years, I can only conclude that our world is in a collective spiritual crisis. That our world is in a collective spiritual crisis." And she defines spirituality as, "Spirituality is recognizing and celebrating that we are all inextricably connected to each other by a power greater than all of us, and that our connection to that power and to one another is grounded in love and compassion." So I actually happen to think that she's right, that we are in the midst of a global spiritual crisis. Which now leads us back, so we're going to park those two things for now, leads us back to the question of the divinity of Jesus. Listening to the Neil Gaiman lecture reinforced for me the sheer genius of Jesus. He was brilliant. He was asked questions, he answered with stories. Stories like the prodigal son, which are about every family that ever was. Stories like the Good Samaritan that draws us into the experience of this story and has a huge surprise and a kick at the end, when the hated one is the one who is merciful. So the parables, even the toughest of parables, show that Jesus had one goal: empathy. To create and build empathy. To put yourselves in the other place of the other. Jesus lived in extremely harsh times. Power was authoritarian. It was top-down. There was no democracy, no free press. There was no press. The demand was obedience or death. And death was by crucifixion. It was an anxious and fearful world. And the temptation must have been to retreat, not to step out. And all that Jesus had to conquer an empire, to change an empire, to change a whole system of power and authority that was global at that time, All he had were stories. All he had were these stories about God and about people like you and me. That's all that he had. Stories that invite us to imagine what the world could be like. Stories that continue to challenge our preconceptions of how the world is meant to be. I performed a wedding yesterday, Charlotte Cameron and Piper's daughter, both of them have been in our choir here, and I said in my address that one of the things that is key, I think, in marriage is that you need to be kind to one another. To have a long-term, sustainable marriage, you need to be kind to one another because it's not a kind world. Right now, it's a fearful, angry, and anxious world. And it needs simple human kindness more than anything else. And Jesus was a kind man. He was many other things. He was brave, he was courageous, but he was also kind. So do I believe that Jesus was divine? To answer that, we need to do a bit of a history lesson. And I just want to check here and see how many people went along with me to the trip to the Royal Ontario Museum that looked at ancient Rome. And for those of you who were, this is a refresher. And for those of you who are not, it'll be, again, a bit of a learning for you. So every Roman house had a shrine in it, and the shrine would have the household gods. Janus, who was the god of doorways and beginnings. Cardia, the goddess of hinges. Forculus, the god of doors. Lamentus, the god of the threshold. And Vesta, the goddess of the hearth, who was very, very central. And every Roman would give a little bit of food to throw into the fire. And along with these little gods that would be brought out and part of the shrine, you'd have the spirits. The Lares were the spirits of the ancestors. The Penates were the spirits of the larder. And you would take the Penates figurine and put it on the table at mealtimes. And if you asked these Romans, were these figures divine? They would say, well, of course. But what do you mean by divine? Do you mean all-powerful, controlling the universe and the world and your daily life? Well, they would say, no. No, of course not. But you need to acknowledge them. They have influence, but not control. They also worship or had Augustus as divine. He was the divine Augustus. Now, why was he considered divine? Because he brought universal peace. He brought an end to civil war. He brought an end to the wars that were tearing Rome apart. And he brought peace to the empire. And for that, divinity in those days could mean an essence similar to a god. Now, nobody thought that Augustus created heaven and earth, but what he did was he put an end to the violence, and for the first time, people felt safe and secure. Safe and secure. Now, we look at these Romans and we think, oh my gosh, look at the things they bring out in their little household shrine, the little gods they bring out for dinner. And, you know, we think, how superstitious. Well, it would be really interesting to see what a Roman would say about our culture. Can I get the first picture up? So, this is a picture of it is the selfie toaster. So you take a selfie, it goes in the toaster, and so your toast comes out with your picture on the toast. You can get the picture of your face on your toast every morning. And so a Roman will look at that and say, oh, that's really clear. They worship themselves. This next picture, please. So this is a picture of the new iPhone, the iPhone X, at about $1,300. And the Romans would look at us wandering around with these things, and we have our heads bowed in prayer as we check them all. And he would say, well, clearly they're worshiping these. These are their sacred objects because they carry them with them everywhere they go. And they would also look at other things and say that we worship them. Next slide, Facebook. Next slide, Instagram and Twitter. All of these things a Roman would look at and say, there's no difference between what we're doing and you're doing. It is just different contexts and different items, but the same thing. So again now, how do we look at that and approach the divinity of Jesus? Well, we have two passages today. One is a letter from Paul, and the other is a story trying to explain Jesus. And the point of the stories is not that they are factual of this, the first or the second story, first story is a letter, but the truth lies in what they mean. And what do they mean? So the Transfiguration story that we have today is one of my least favorite scriptures. I skip it as much as possible. You can try and Eleanor will confirm that. But it's an identity story. Answer the question, who is Jesus? And all the people that would have been reading this gospel or hearing it for the first time would have had a question. They would have heard all these amazing stories, and they'd be saying to themselves, who is Jesus? Who is this person? And the Transfiguration is an answer to the question. The question of who is Jesus? And the Transfiguration says, Jesus is God's son and part of the line of Moses to Elijah. That Jesus is part of that family that is close to God and connected to God in a unique way. This, says Luke, is who Jesus is. Chosen by God. Chosen by God. Paul's story isn't a story, it's a letter. And Paul, in his letters, tries to explain what it means to be the church and to understand who Jesus was. And what it means to be a community of faith. And so Paul adds layers of meaning trying to answer the central question of who Jesus is. Last week we looked at who God is, and that no one here, I believe, had a central idea of who God is. And it'd be the same thing if I asked everyone who Jesus is. Completely the same. Some would say he's a teacher, others would say he's a rabbi, others a role model, others the son of God. So let me ask you a question, rhetorical question. Do you believe that there is a spark of the divine, a spark of God in every human being? I think there is, and I think that in Jesus that was spark was a furnace, it was a bonfire. He had an incredible connection to God. And so if you ask me then, do I see divinity in Jesus? My answer is yes. I see divinity when Jesus speaks to the Samaritan woman at the well, who is despised and alone and cut off from her society and her culture. And no one else will talk to her. Jesus embraces her and brings her back into the circle of community. When he reaches out to the lepers, who everyone else shuns and fears, I see the divine in action. When he calls Zacchaeus, come out of your tree, Zacchaeus, for I must eat with you. And Zacchaeus was the tax collector who was a hated quisling, a traitor to his people. Yet Jesus calls him down and eats with him, enraging everybody. And that I see the divine. And in the action that Jesus takes to create an inclusive community of both men and women, and one that breaks all the barriers, I see the divine in Jesus. And at the last, on the cross, when he cries out, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do, when he calls out forgiveness in the midst of unspeakable agony, I see the divine in Jesus. The question, I think, for us is not so much whether Jesus is divine, but rather, would the world see the divine in this community and the church at large? Do we reflect and relive these stories in a way that speaks to the spiritual crisis that Brené Brown talks about to our world? We are part of a model of church that is 500 years old. For 500 years, it very successfully gave an experience of the divine to people. And it's a model I love. I love the music, its forms, its worship. It speaks to me, it feeds me, it always has, and it always will. But if it doesn't for most of our society, then it is time we create something new. New wine and new wineskins. To dream and imagine what that could be. One of my oldest friends, a woman by the name of Sandra Severs, she was a friend from seminary. And she was a minister in the United Church of Canada, but she was so bruised and battered by her experience in ministry that no longer is she a minister in the United Church of Canada, but she has left the United Church of Canada because of it. And in a message to me last week, she wrote the following. We are knitting a web of relationships which can't be measured by the number of stitches we cast onto our needles. Let me say that one more time. We are knitting a web of relationships which can't be measured by the number of stitches we cast onto our needles. We are knitting a web of relationships here. That's what Jesus did. That's what the church can do in the 21st century. Knit a new web of relationships that shows the divine.